So I don't know very much about the UNESCO program or UNESCO itself, but just from a little bit of research, the UNESCO Memory of the World Register was established in 1992. It aims to preserve items of cultural and historical significance. It contains currently 429 items, and 52% of those are from Europe and the US, only 22% from Asia and Pacific. And I think this is perhaps a little bit imbalanced. We need those of us who work in the field of Asian culture need to step up our game and make sure that Asian culture is properly represented there. There are a number of Buddhist scriptures already on the register, and according again to my very brief researches, from Myanmar we have the Kutador inscription shrines, which in fact Dr. Mark Allen is working on, and he'll speak more to that a bit later. From India, we have the Gilgit manuscripts, which is a very important collection of Sanskrit manuscripts recovered of Buddhist texts, and make one of the prime sources for the Sanskrit Buddhist texts that are available today. There are these other two texts that are mentioned there, neither of which I know very much about. Maitreya Vyakarana is a prophecy of the coming of Lord Maitreya. And the other one is a tantric text. I'm not quite sure what the significance of those are and why they're there, but anyway, that's what's there. From Mongolia, we have a kanjur written with 9 precious stones, which essentially is a highly decorative and very beautifully artistically made kanjur, the kanjur being the Tibetan Buddhist canon. And this is the Mongolian translation of the Tibetan Buddhist canon. So translated from mostly Sanskrit into Tibetan, and then from Tibetan, I believe, translated into Mongolian. That's right. It's not just written in Mongolian script. I think actually, is that correct? I think actually translated into Mongolian language, yeah. So the Kanjur being the canonical text and the Tanjur being the commentarial text. So Mongolia is fairly well represented. From Korea, we have, of course, the famous Tripitaka Koreana, which is a 13th century woodblock inscriptions of the entire Chinese Tripitaka. All right. So these are texts which were mostly taken from India to China and translated into Chinese. Don't be misled by the fact that it's in Korea. It's, in fact, a Chinese scripture. It just happens to have been written down in Korea. And those woodblocks are an incredible physical record of the ancient world. They're still in immaculate physical condition, beautifully inscribed and preserved for 700 years, and they now form the basis of virtually all of our modern Chinese Buddhist texts. So the modern Chinese digital editions of texts are all taken from that Tripitaka Koreana. From China, Tibet, Sri Lanka, Vietnam, Japan, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, and Bhutan, we have nothing. No Buddhist scriptures from any of those countries in the UNESCO register. So a little bit of work to do. Okay? So very glad to see that Sri Lanka is now making this proposal. So then the question is, why should we include the Pali Tripitaka from Sri Lanka? After all, we possess many different Buddhist scripts texts from the early period. Right? There are the Pali texts also from Thailand and Burma and other places as well, Cambodia and so on. We possess many early Buddhist texts, pre-Mahayana texts, that are not in Pali. And in fact, the number of texts we possess that are not in Pali are greater in number than the ones we do possess in Pali. And again, just to clarify here, I'm not talking about Mahayana scriptures or tantras or anything like that. I'm talking about canonical suttas, vinayas, and abhidhamma, which is essentially from the same historical period as the Pali canon, but translated into Chinese, largely, or into Tibetan, and also a number of those in Sanskrit, Gandhari, and other languages. And the total number of those texts is greater than the number of texts we have in Pali. Mainly because in the Chinese collection they gathered many different collections, like sometimes multiple collections and many different vinayas and so on, which were translated. So what's special about the Pali Tripitaka that justifies including this on the UNESCO register from Sri Lanka specifically rather than anything else? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to discuss a number of different areas that I think give a special significance to the Pali Tripitaka, and especially the Pali Tripitaka from a Sri Lankan perspective. And of course, that's not to minimize the significance of the scriptures of other countries, or indeed, it's not to minimize the significance of scriptures other than the Pali Tripitaka. And I think that one thing that, Mark and I discussed a bit earlier is that, you know, from our point of view, we would like to see, you know, our primary work is with the Pali Tripitaka. This is our field of study, and obviously it is very important, but there are many other writings and scriptures and manuscripts in Sri Lanka for more than 2,000 years, which are also very much worth preserving. So we certainly wouldn't like to see this restricted to only the Pali Tripitaka, but we would like to see that the Pali Tripitaka being an inspiration or a spur to being a greater awareness for preserving of the literary heritage more generally. Sri Lanka, of course, was, before the modern times, was, I believe, the most literate country in the world. Yeah, certainly one of the most literate, probably the most literate country in the world. And so there's a great literature there, much of which is still very much unknown. So here are some things why we should be considering the Pali Canon as significant. The cultural significance. Okay, so I'm not going to speak in very much detail about this because I'm not a student of Sri Lankan history and culture, but simply to remark that Pali Tripitaka is, of course, the foundation for religion and culture in Sri Lanka and has been for over 2,000 years. And the contribution that it's made in that respect is inestimable. And so that is one of the great values of it. It also has a broader historical significance in that the Pali Tripitaka was taken from Sri Lanka to Southeast Asia and later to the rest of the world. And again, just to clarify this point, for those of you who may be not so familiar with the history, after Buddhism began in India, it spread over many lands, generally following the trade routes. And within not very long after the Buddha, maybe 400 years or so after the Buddha, it had already gone as far as China. And so this is following the sea routes through Southeast Asia, as well as over the Silk Road through Central Asia. And wherever these trade routes were established, then Buddhism would follow. And so Buddhism went from India to all of these places, what we'd call today Burma, Bangladesh, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, Vietnam, and to China, and then later to Korea and Japan. So the Buddhism that was brought to these countries was brought from a number of different schools of Buddhism, most of which do not exist anymore. So these are ancient schools of Buddhism that flourished in India 1,500 years ago, and that went through with their own scriptures, which, you know, would have been similar to the Pali scriptures in many ways, but not exactly identical with what we call the Pali canon today. And so these different kinds of Buddhism flourished throughout Asia until roughly about 1100, 1200 AD, at which time the Pali Tripitaka was established throughout that region, throughout the Southeast Asian region. So from that time, from about the 12th century onwards, the Pali canon and the Theravada Buddhism, the school which established the Pali canon, was the only or dominant form of Buddhism throughout the whole Southeast Asian region. So for that reason, it has a significance which is greater than just for Sri Lanka. Which brings us to another point, which is there's a sociological significance to the Pali Canon. In many cases, we have scriptures that, for example, the Gilgit manuscripts I mentioned earlier, Sanskrit manuscripts, and these are archaeological finds. Right? These are more or less dug out of the desert and caves and so on. Of course, it's fantastic to find these things, but they don't have any connection with any ongoing culture. Right? They're just physical items. They tell us about the past, but they don't really have that continuity. So the Pali Tripitaka is the only early Buddhist scriptural collection for which we have a continuous living tradition. And again, to clarify, within the Chinese Tibetan traditions, or more generally the East Asian and Central Asian traditions, they preserve many of the same scriptures as we have in the Pali Canon. So they'll have, you're familiar with the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, so they have versions of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, and they'll have versions of the Satipatthana Sutta, and they'll have versions of these different texts that we're familiar with from the Pali Canon. And yet those texts are typically not particularly prominent or important within those traditions. They tend to lie fallow. There's a difference between having a text in your case of books on a shrine and the ones that people actually read and practice. So within traditionally, within Chinese Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism, of course, the main scriptures they were interested in were the Mahayana sutras, and the early sutras were preserved, but they weren't really read or studied or practiced. That's changing today, and there is an upsurge of interest in the early scriptures, especially in Taiwan and East Asian Buddhism, and to some degree within Tibetan Buddhism as well. But the Pali Tripitaka is the only one where there is a continuous historical tradition of people actually living and practicing, building their whole culture around these scriptures. Okay. So another point of significance of the Pali Tripitaka is that it has a doctrinal significance. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that we have a complete canonical collection from one specific school. And this is something we don't find for any of the other schools of Buddhism. So, for example, in the Chinese Taisho Tripitaka, we have the Dīrghāgama, which is similar to the Pali Dīgha Nikāya, and that's from, last time I looked, the Dharmaguptaka school. Any revision on that recently, Mark? No? Still from the Dharmaguptaka. The Madhyamagama from the Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada school. Sanyuktagama, also Sarvastivada. Ekotarikagama. Any recent progress on that one as far as you know? So the Ekotarikagama is disputed, often said to be Mahasangika, but not really certain. So we have different collections from different schools. Now, of course, that has its own interest, right? It allows us to see something of the similarities and differences between the different schools, the different languages they use, the different emphasis they had in their scriptures, and so on. But there's also something that's very valuable to have an entire collection from one school, and to see that this consists of more or less a complete system. So the Buddhist traditions have this idea of the Tripitaka. Right, so we're talking about the Tripitaka, right, the three baskets, Sutta, Vinaya, and Abhidhamma. And the different traditions have this idea of the Tripitaka. But the actual reality of the Tripitaka is not so clear. And especially in the Chinese and Tibetan canons, they have so many different scriptures from so many different periods. It's not exactly clear what the Tripitaka actually means in reality, apart from just the idea of the Tripitaka. Whereas with the Pali Tripitaka, we have a relatively clear set of scriptures. Not completely clear, because even within Pali there is some dispute about exactly what belongs to the Tripitaka, but generally speaking we have a clear idea and a complete doctrinal connection from a single school, so we're able to see the sort of the whole picture of the early texts from that school. There's also a linguistic significance. So Pali Tripitaka is the only extensive collection preserved in an early Indic dialect. Most of the ones I've mentioned, the Chinese and so on, are in translation. So obviously there's a certain degree of fuzziness when you come to read a translated text. Other texts are in early Indic dialects, like in Sanskrit or Gandhari and others, but these are much more partial and much more incomplete. So here we have a complete collection in an early Indic dialect. And in addition, the Pali texts are on the whole clear, consistent and well-edited. And this is something which is very nice and very useful, especially for students. Now, again, just to be clear, from a historical point of view, to be well-edited and consistent doesn't necessarily mean that it's good, because something can be very valuable, even if it's a bit carelessly written, right? And indeed, a certain irregularity is a product of humanity, right? That we're not always consistent in the way we do things. So being very well edited can also be a sign of something that's been very polished and edited later on by lots of committees, right? But it does mean that it's a lot easier to read them. And I've, over the last 3 years, I've translated the four Nikayas from Pali to English, and I can say from doing that work, my goodness, it's so nice to be able to work with the Pali texts. Very smooth, very easy. Of course, there's lots of problems doing things. But when we move from there to look at the Sanskrit texts, hybrid Sanskrit, and so on, then tends to be much more of a struggle to read them. Part of the reason for that is that the Pali Tripitaka is the only early Buddhist scriptural collection which is accompanied by detailed and systematic commentaries on virtually every text. So within, say, the Chinese-Tibetan traditions, yes, we find various commentaries and so on, but we don't find the systematic commentaries on everything which you have in the Pali canon. And this is something which is an incredible boon for scholars. And, you know, it's almost impossible to overstate the value of the commentaries for modern scholarship. Our dictionaries, for example, a very large percentage of entries in our Pali dictionaries really consist of paraphrases of what the commentary says. In modern times, commentaries have become quite controversial. On the one hand, there are those who believe that everything in the commentaries must be taken as being true, and that something in the commentaries is equivalent to the word of the Buddha. I think that's a bit overstating it. Commentaries are the opinions of the lineages of teachers, and sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. And so there are others who say, because there are mistakes in the commentaries, we should reject them all out of hand, and it's actively misleading to read the commentaries. And as soon as you say this is found in the commentaries, then it's a good reason to not believe it, right? That's another extreme point of view, yeah? And so anyone doing serious study of the Buddhist tradition will know the value and the worth of the commentaries, but they will also know that commentaries need to be read and interpreted with care, because there was, after all, 1,000 years between the time of the canon and the time of the commentaries. So this is one of the great advantages also of the Pali canon. There's also pedagogical significance. So the Pali Tripitaka is and will continue to be the primary basis for learning about early Buddhism, right? No matter what we think and no matter what we want to do. I've been running Sutta Central since 2005, and one of the whole purposes of Sutta Central was to bring in the Chinese, Tibetan and Sanskrit parallels and to show the connections between the Pali scriptures and the scriptures in other languages, and to try to encourage people to take an interest in these things and to start reading them and so on. And yet, despite that, you know, we still have the overwhelming number of translations on our site. Probably 98% of our translations are from Pali rather than from Chinese and Sanskrit and Tibetan. That's what people know. It's what people are taught. It's what the base, it's what the mass of books explaining suttas is about. It's what the introductions to suttas are based on. And so those of us who learn about early Buddhism, we come through Pali and then we encounter the other ones later on. And for all of those reasons I mentioned above, because of the linguistic clarity, the commentaries and so on, then there are good reasons why that's the case. So even though I would very much like to see more emphasis placed on learning about the Chinese and other scriptures, still the reality is that the Pali will be the basis for learning about early Buddhism. And I might say studying the Pali suttas and the early suttas should be the basis not just for learning about early Buddhism, but should be the basis for learning about any form of Buddhism. And I believe that it's foolish to attempt to study or learn about later or modern forms of Buddhism without having a grounding in the teachings of the Pali canon. There's also a modern significance. Pali Tripitaka inspired the modernist revival of Buddhism throughout Asia. And this is something which I think we have lost sight of a little bit. Now, I'm not, of course, claiming that the Pali Canon was the only inspiration for modernist Buddhism. It was one of the important ones. These days, when we look at the kinds of Buddhism that we look and we see around us are almost always what we would call modernist Buddhism in one way or another. Okay? And we can hardly find a form of Buddhism that hasn't been affected by modernity in some way or another. And that adaptation of Buddhism to modern times occurred in all Buddhist countries, and it occurred in various different ways. Within the Theravada Buddhist countries, and also to a large extent within Eastern Asian countries, especially Taiwan and Japan, it was in the 19th century recognized that the Pali Canon, especially the Pali Suttas, were the foundational texts of Buddhism, the earliest scriptures. And early scholars such as Thomas Rhys Davids and many others argued that what we find in the Pali text is a rational philosophy and psychology which was in accord with science. Okay? And this idea that Buddhism is modern, we've seen so many times these kinds of quotes, like Albert Einstein saying, if there's got to be a religion which suits the modern times, then it should be Buddhism, right? That's where this comes from. That's how Einstein learnt about these things, right? He learnt about these things from the Pali Canon via interpreters like Thomas Rhys Davids and so on. Yeah? So that whole question of modernity and the adaptation of Buddhism is, of course, a complex one, because Buddhism is a complex subject. It encompasses many millions of people and so on. But there's no doubt that the Pali Canon was a major force in that. Prior to the modern period, it seems probably unlikely that there was very much direct study of the Pali Canon within Theravadan countries, or within most of the time within Theravadan countries. Most people would have been learning Buddhism from later, either directly from teachers or from later texts and compilations and so on. But in the 19th century, people started translating Pali texts into modern languages and started arguing for the existence of a early Buddhism which was based on rational, psychological and philosophical principles which could be the foundation of a form of Buddhism that's relevant in the modern world. I think I put historical significance twice. Anyway, so this, I should probably change that one. When compared with other early texts, Pali texts on the whole appear to be relatively early and uncorrupted. Now, I'm going to add a lot of caveats here, and please do not take me the wrong way. By uncorrupted, I don't mean free of evil influences, okay? For a textual corruption is not an evil influence. It's just a sign that there's some kind of mistake or issue or something in the text, right? It doesn't mean that somebody's come along and said, mwahaha, I'm going to wave my evil wand and make this a bad thing, okay? So what do I mean by that? And this is probably somewhat controversial, and other scholars in the room, please feel free to disagree with me on this point. But when I compare, say, a Pali text with a Chinese text and Sanskrit text, it seems to me that generally speaking, on average and on the whole, the Pali text is most likely to be somewhat earlier than the other versions. So this is not a fundamentalist claim. I'm not saying that all the Pali texts must be earlier than later. It's easy to find examples where Pali texts seem to be later than other texts in Sanskrit or whatever. But on the whole, they seem to be somewhat earlier and free of later influences. And I think the reason for that was because the specific emphasis in the Theravadan tradition, especially the early Theravadan tradition of the Mahavihara in Anuradhapura, saw its identity in terms of textual purity and preservation. And I think that they put a lot of emphasis on this. If we look at the early accounts of the first schism or the first breakup in the Buddhist schools, one of the early accounts of that from the Theravadan tradition is found in the Dipawangsa, and there it accuses the Mahasanghikas not of doctrinal laxity, but of corrupting their texts. They mix up the nouns and the verbs, and they got their plurals and singulars wrong, and all of these kinds of things. That's their mistake. Yeah? And when we read Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit texts from the Mahasanghika school today, then it's easy to see why they would have that impression. Because compared to Pali, yes, that's how they look. Right, and of course the Sanskritists would see it differently, but it's easy to understand how those from the Pali tradition would see that they are maintaining a very pure, very pristine tradition. And so it's not that the Theravada tradition did not invent and write later scriptures and these kinds of things? Of course they did. And, you know, the Theravada tradition is full of later scriptures of all different kinds. But those later scriptures and teachings tended to be placed in separate books. So they wrote new books and put their new teachings in them rather than interpolating them into the early books. So again, this is just a general observation. Please don't take this as an absolute in any way. But on the whole, I think that the Pali texts are relatively early compared to the others. Finally, the spiritual significance. And many people, including myself, regard the Pali Tripitaka as their sacred scripture, believing that it contains the teachings of the Buddha himself and that these teachings lead to freedom from suffering. And this is a belief and an inspiration that inspires people throughout the Theravadan world, in Sri Lanka, in other countries throughout Asia, and now through all of the countries of the world, where we find people who look to these scriptures and who find things in them of meaning that actually change their lives. And people take up meditation based on these scriptures. They reform their lives. They give up bad things. They give up killing. They try to become a better person. They gain a sense of wisdom. They gain a sense of peace and confidence through reading these scriptures and putting them into practice. And so this is something which means that this literature still has that living significance as a spiritual guide for so many people. So here are the words which were given by the Buddha shortly after his enlightenment, Bodhgaya, after he was initially reluctant to teach the Dhamma, and he was persuaded by Lord Brahma to teach, and said the famous words of Parutate Sangamatasa Dwara Yesotavanto Pumunchantu Sadhang. Flung open are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears to hear decide their faith. So thank you so much for your attention this evening, and I would like to hand you over to Mark Allen to give his presentation.